impression of time, space, and we move in this marvelous world that the brain gives us. All right, now, in the same way, we find Gardner's multiple intelligences, or Montessori's multiple intelligences, and so on. As these fields of non-localized energy, the brain localizes them as our experience, and we all share the same world out there because we're all drawing on what? The same fields. Evolution's End starts, first chapter, with a phenomenon we call the idiosavant. And recently, Adele Treffert, medical doctor who's been working with idiosavants for 30 years or so, turned out the first real study that has ever been done. Scientists have ignored and, in fact, avoided the idiosavant at all costs because they challenge every scientific notion we have going. Now, the idiosavant, the word idiot meaning they simply are total idiots. They have an average IQ of about 25. And they call them savants, which is the French word for learned person, because in spite of being totally uneducable, most of them have to be fed and clothed and led around by the hand. They're nearly always institutionalized. They're really vegetables, kind of walking vegetables. But they have access to one of the major fields of intelligence. They have direct access to it, unmediated access to it, but they can't access the field themselves. You have to ask them a question about that field of activity, and instantly the answer will come from them, and they are infallible. They never make errors. Now, how are you going to account for this? These people can't read or write. They can't be taught. Their vocabulary sometimes is almost non-existent, limited until you punch their button, and now it'll come for hours and hours information concerning that field of activity or possibility.
It's a pleasure and a privilege to be with Joseph Chilton Pierce. Joe has been writing and speaking about human development all over the world and for many years. He's the author of numerous books, including his national bestseller, The Magical Child. Joe, I often use the phrase, the intelligence of play. What is the relationship between play and learning?
They are certainly interdependent. You can't have real learning with the child unless they are playing. Real playing is how real learning takes place. You can have conditioning, kind of Pavlovian conditioning of his dogs or behavior modifications through other means, which we look on as very serious and which we generally call learning. But it's not learning. It's conditioning. Real learning takes place by what Maria Montessori would call the absorbent mind of the child, simply absorbing their universe, absorbing it, becoming it, and they do this through play. Play can be the most serious undertaking of a child's life. It is the most serious undertaking. They are completely entrained in play. Mind, the three parts of the mind, thought, feeling, action, the body, every aspect of the child's self entrains solely, focuses totally on the activity of absorbing their world, absorbing their environment. It's the most serious activity of their life because they're literally building their construction of knowledge of a world, of themselves, of the relationship between the two, and laying down all the foundations for the later forms of intelligence. And in all of that, play is the activity itself. So you have those two things. What we think of as learning is conditioning. Training is conditioning. But real learning is that state of play. We have to interrupt the child's real state of learning or play in order to bring about what we think should be their training and their conditioning.
If the state of play is the optimum state for learning and performance, then what's going on in school, which is often not exactly playful?
Well, schools are set up for conditioning. There are certain aspects of the child we want to train to respond in certain ways through schooling. This is what they operate conditioning, behavior modifications. In each case, we must interrupt the child's real learning process of play in order to bring about these conditionings, which we think they should have. So our entire schooling is set up largely on conditioning rather than learning in the only way the child can learn, which is through what we as an adult interpret as play. I think this is one of the reasons we find a very small percentage of retention of the conditioning we think we're putting our children through. I remember the Carnegie Institute's famous statement, I think it was the Carnegie Institute back in 63 even, way back then, that a child seems to retain only 3 to 5% of the total information or conditioning modifications we're trying to bring about 3 to 5% retention. Whereas that which is learned in a state of play is literally built in as a permanent neural patterning in the brain, which they never lose. If we could just recognize the direct correspondence between play and learning, and the dramatic difference between that and conditioning, and by simply shifting over, I think our entire schooling could be extremely successful and produce, say, 95% retention, but it would have to be within the frame by the way by which nature has set up the learning process in the child.
We have what you call real learning, which occurs in the state of authentic play, and we have training and conditioning and behavior modification. Is there a place for both?
Well, first we have to recognize there are ways in which we must employ conditioning to the child right from the very beginning. There is no doubt of that, particularly in the modern world, where many things have to be off limits to that child. They have to learn that there are certain ways they can move and certain ways they can't, because they'll be killed. I mean, it's just simply not safe. So this is conditioning. But on the other hand, for the child's real openings and all, they must have that world of play established by the adult establishing that safe, secure space with them. If we mistaken these two, if we get them mixed up and we're not aware of the child's need for the play exercise, as well as the condition, if we try to make the play the conditioning, or if we try to condition play, then we're going to mess up the whole neural development itself. If you look at the world of the child of the dream around 3 or 4, when they're beginning to be able to come into dominion over their own structures of knowledge about a world self and language and all inside themselves, and want to create these inner worlds and then play them out in their own private world. This is a private world. But here we're worried about the child being socialized, and we think they should all be crammed together to learn to play together, but they don't play together. Each plays in their own private individual world. If they might all have to be sharing the same physical space, but they're not sharing the same mental world space at all. And then if we take the conditioning of schooling and interfere with that early period, making them sit at desks, conditioning their bodies not to move when all learning is sensorimotor at that period, all learning of the child from that 4 to 7 period is verbal. They talk out their world all the time. They're always speaking to themselves. That plays a critical part in the whole thing. And suddenly we're making them sit at desks to attend abstract, metaphoric, symbolic structures, restricting their body movement. And we're conditioning them. We're trying to condition that mind, modify those natural behaviors on the part of our adult ideas. Then obviously you're not going to have the foundation laid for the very thing you're after later on in their ability to handle very abstract, metaphoric, symbolic structures. The same thing with all the stages of play that I can see. We've taken a later adult concept and try to inflict it on the child or impose it on the child out of appropriate age consideration, which then becomes conditioning and blocks the natural unfolding and absorption of their universe as designed by nature during that period.
The state of play with its curiosity and wonder remains the same. What changes is the type of activity which is appropriate for each age. Let's start at the beginning.
If you look at the period, say, from 1 to 4, imitation plays a critical role in it, imitative play. They look at it and they see their parents or their models doing certain things. They want to do the same kinds of activity within their own world. The little jar top becoming the mixing bowl that the mother's using, the little spool of thread becoming the automobile the father is driving, or whatever it might be, representational objects and metaphoric thinking, symbolic thinking, all to imitate within a small world that they can control and monitor and manage the great huge adult world that they're preparing themselves for. So this is imitative play, which is the foundations of metaphoric symbolic thought that we use in abstract languages and mathematics and chemical formulas and so on. But then you have a shift. Around 4, what Piaget calls the child of the dream, the great period of intuitive thinking begins, and the creation of internal worlds, no longer just imitative, but now you're using that the world you've got established to move within and create other worlds of your own making. And we speak of the child of the dream, and their play is quite different from the earlier child.
Okay, let's move on to the next major stage. How does the play activity change?
Now at age 7 to about 11, they want to make things. They want to take their actual living physical world, take an internal idea, and change the physical world with it. Such simple things as making cookies, taking a lot of different ingredients, putting them together, doing a certain thing with them called heat, and it comes out radical transformation. Here's this marvelous thing called a cookie from these totally inert ingredients and different, and so on. Play of any sort along this line of making things. All art is a form of play in this respect.
What you're describing is imagination, and how developing the capacity for imagination literally changes how we relate to the world. What happens if this capacity to imagine isn't developed?
The Swedish pediatrics group are the first ones to come out with the statement that the child with imagination doesn't resort to violence, because they have an almost endless alternate number of scenarios within that they can play out, which they then know will have some effect on their external world. Whereas the child without imagination is subject to the instant real time of direct sensory input. And so if that direct sensory input is in any way threatening or demeaning, they have no choice except to try to cut off the source of the input. Whereas the child with imagination can modulate these lower immediate defensive mechanisms with the higher imaginative ones that go on in the neocortical structure by which we can moderate the lower. And again, it gets back down to the simple thing of representing the spool as the road roller or the steamroller or the automobile or something of that nature. The image that the child has in their mind that isn't present to the sensory system, what we call imagination, and an image created within, not present to the sensory system, which they then take and project on the direct sensory object of the spool. And through that, they moderate or modulate the sensory object of the spool and see it as standing for the road roller, the automobile, or whatever it might be, and they want to play that for hours and hours. Later on, these very low sensory inputs of the drive for survival, protection, et cetera, can be moderated or modulated by the same higher cortical structures which create the internal image and project it on the external and change it into the nature of the internal. So if we don't put those structures, those abilities or capacities which nature is expecting in at their appropriate stage, then later on, there's not only no ability for metaphoric symbolic thinking as found in number systems, physics formulas, and all of the different languages we use, but no way to moderate one's own behavior.
It's been said that play must be learned, and that a child not played with can't play. What do you think this means?
So long as we remember when we use the word play, we're talking about nature's means for learning. So when we say the child not played with cannot learn to play, in effect, the child's learning is seriously impaired. So later on, when they're exhibiting all these extremely violent behaviors and so on, we can say that they did not learn. By learning, we mean opening and developing higher cortical structures, which can moderate or modulate the lower evolutionary structures of the brain. Just that simple. That just didn't happen with them because they weren't played with. Play didn't take place. Play being the learning, and the learning being the opening of those blocks of intelligences which are literally genetically encoded in these particular topographical areas of the brain in their respective order as they appear on the evolutionary scene. This doesn't happen. And then we turn around and condemn these people for moral ethical failure when really we're simply looking at very, very pragmatic, very common sense kind of biological failure.
This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Living Dialogues is sponsored by Audible. Bestsellers in philosophy, spirituality, and self-help. Download your free audiobook from over 40,000 titles. Sign up for your risk-free trial at audiblepodcast.com/living. Join today. Cancel any time in the first 2 weeks and keep your free book as your gift. You're going to love being an Audible listener.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have Joseph Chilton Pierce, author known to many of you for his works Crack in the Cosmic Egg, the national bestseller The Magical Child, Rediscovering Nature's Plan for Our Children, Evolution's End, and most recently, The Biology of Transcendence. For over 25 years, Joe has been acclaimed and featured internationally in his lectures on human development and the changing needs of children. So, Joseph Chilton Pierce, it's really a great delight to have you here in the studio.
Well, thank you, Duncan.
I think it might be very interesting to our audience to begin our dialogue here by perhaps reviewing very briefly the evolution of your own thinking and research, beginning with, over 25 years ago, your book Crack in the Cosmic Egg, and then proceeding through The Magical Child, and a decade ago, Evolution's End. And we might then talk about the book The Biology of Transcendence.
Well, the other day pulled out my book to Crack in the Cosmic Egg and started looking at it because a publisher was going to bring it out for another edition. It was in print for 28 years, and so he's bringing it out again. I hadn't looked at the book in many a year, and I was really astonished to find that nearly everything I've been saying ever since is found in that book.
I was kind of depressed because I thought, well, if I understood this much way back then, why haven't I acted it out a little bit better on the general scene? But the magical child, of course, came a number of years later, dealing specifically with children, and then Evolution's End, dealing with some of the real crises that we're facing with our children in this day and time. And my new book, The Biology of Transcendence, boils it all down to the bioculturalism, as it's called, the effect of culture on our biological system, mm-hmm. and the way our biological system then affects culture in turn.
And at one point, Joe, you mentioned a phrase that culture is the enemy of biology. And so let's talk about that theme of how culture actually, instead of nourishing, actually can impede the evolutionary spiral of human consciousness.
Well, I will say that in my short 76 years, I've heard one big theme over and over all my life, and that is reform. Everything has been in a process of reformation. We have to go down and clean up the mess in Washington. We must clean up the mess in the state capitol. We must reform our schools. We must reform medicine. We must reform this. Everything in a constant state of reformation. Culture survives only by our attempts to improve it. And it preserves itself or perpetuates itself by convincing us that we must improve culture at all cost. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is culture cannot be improved, and it should never be sustained, but it's sustained by our attempts to make it work right. And every facet of contemporary life, leaving nothing out at all, every facet of life is simply an adjunct of culture. And culture is the enemy of the true biological nature of the human being.
At one point in our conversation earlier, you defined culture as a body of knowledge concerning physical survival in a hostile world based on fear. So that culture, in a sense, is a survival mechanism that's passed on by belief systems from generation to generation. And it is often then at odds with the transcending adaptive spiral of human consciousness, which is literally hardwired, if we will, into our biology. So perhaps we could ask you to comment on that.
Well, I know it's hardwired in, but you have to define your term transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm basing my book and the definition of transcendence on the dictionary, which says simply, transcendence is the ability to rise above and go beyond limitation and constraint.
Mm-hmm.
Our inability to rise beyond and go beyond our current limitation and constraint leads us to all of our violence. We have in this life a choice between two things, either transcendence or violence, and there's nothing much in between.
Mm-hmm.
Culture depends on violence. Culture breeds violence, and culture thrives on violence. Gil Bailey, you might be familiar with Gil Bailey, who wrote a book called Violence Unveiled, Culture at the Humanity at the Crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
He was a follower of René Girard, the great French philosopher, who did his life study on the effect of culture and the way culture preserves itself through violence. And of course, all this is very anarchy. It's anarchistic. It's anti-cultural. To be anti-cultural is to be virtually anti to every single aspect of what we think of as civilization. But all of my books from the beginning on have really been dealing with culture, and I wasn't aware of it until the past few years. And that our natural biological system is designed to constantly evolve and rise above the limitations and constraints of our current state. Blocking this, you have only one reaction in the human being, and that is violence. So we either transcend or we start imploding and destroying ourselves.
And it's such a fascinating perspective, because what it does is give us a sense of how evolution proceeds. I'm thinking now of a book called Earth Household, published over 30 years ago by Gary Snyder, the American poet, and in a series of essays on what is happening to our a larger ecological environment and its interface with human culture, he referred to the civilization establishment. Capital C, civilization, capital E, establishment. And what's being revealed, I think, in our dialogue here and in your work is that culture or civilization is always one step behind. It's consolidating that evolutionary step that has already been made and then trying to make a fortress or a home out of it to preserve some kind of stability or security against the inbuilt.
Anywhere from 60 to 65% of the cells of the heart are actually neural cells, just as you find in the brain. They gather in ganglia rather than the larger fields of the brain, but essentially in the same function, which the John and Beatrice Lacy researched for 30 years under the auspices of the National Institutes of Health and came up with this direct, unmediated neural connection, direct pipeline between the heart and the brain, the fact that there's an ongoing 24-hour-a-day dialogue between the heart and the brain. The three phases of the heartbeat each creates its own initial part of this field effect that surrounds the body, and the first one is very short, but the next one is about 3 feet out, and it's very powerful. They find that they can take a perfectly clear EKG, or electrocardiogram, 3 feet away from the body. You don't have to touch the body. And then, of course, it goes on out 12 to 15 feet away at least. That's easily detectable, and we know now that it goes even further, and all these fields interact one with another. But the critical part for me is the fact that the field that extends out about 3 feet beyond the body is a very powerful field. And you get two of those fields next to each other, and they're going to interact, which gets into the whole issue of mother-child relationships, because that field effect and the overlapping of the field effect created by the heart, each individual heart, is where a great deal of very important information lies. We know, for instance, in the new research that's just come out recently, that the mother's emotional state, which translates directly as what the heart frequency is doing in that mother, determines the shape, character, nature, and quality of the growth of the brain, its neural cells, its capacities in utero. Now comes Alan Shore's work showing that the mother's emotional state and the coherency or incoherency of her heart profoundly affects the infant in the state after birth, particularly the first 9 months, and that her coherent heart frequency realm of influence, which we would refer to as her emotional state, determines whether or not the latest evolutionary addition of the brain, the prefrontal lobes, actually grow or not. That is, the cellular structure, whether the cellular structure is fully developed or not in that infant, depends on the mother's own emotional state, which means the state of her heart. Is it coherent or incoherent to begin with? When the infant is separated from the mother's heart, you have an incoherent frequency. So there can't be entrainment until the infant's heart is brought back into coherency. What brings it back into coherency is its immediate adjacent relationship to the mother's heart. And so her heart lifts the infant's heart out of its incoherent mode into a coherent mode, and then they go into entrainment. When you speak of entrainment of the heart, you're speaking of a very precise, measurable, simply a scientific fact, that the amplitude and the Hertz value of the heart frequencies is coherent. And if that is, then the infant brought into that frame of work will very quickly reflect that coherence. And then you find that they go into exactly the same type of frequency rhythms, which means they entrain.
you could say the waveforms match, so there's no dissonance. When waveforms don't match, we speak of dissonance. If you're listening to a piece of music and all the waveforms are harmonic, then we hear harmony. And if they should suddenly someone go haywire, we hear dissonance. And the same thing with the entrainment between the mother's heart and the infant's heart. Now, this brings about a whole raft of other things. We find that if the infant's heart and the mother's heart are entrained, the brain structures go into entrainment as well. Those frequencies go into entrainment. Now, that entrained state keeps everything coherent and in perfect balance. And that is what we refer to as bonding between mother and infant. Later on, we find this bonding extending out, this ability to entrain with your environment. And the child entrains with their family. And there's harmony in that family because they're all on essentially the same frequency. Failing the initial bond with the mother, all subsequent bonding is not only put at risk, but it's very difficult to bring about. And the failure of a child to bond socially and become an active member of the society is not the child's moral, ethical failure. It's the failure of having established that bond in the beginning on which the later social bonds must be built. And the Harvard study showed clearly that one reflected this throughout life, both in one's health and ability to interact socially with other people. Alan Shore spends a great deal of time and 2,300 research citations to show how the first 18 months of life determine all subsequent moves of intelligence, capacities to relate for the rest of one's life. Why? Because those neural structures for that have to grow in the first 18 months of life, and they grow according to the experience the child is given on an emotional level. And the most interesting thing about Shore's work is he spends the first half of the book on the first 18 months of life, and then he gets into the pathologies that he finds in teenagers and the adult. And he traces all the pathologies in the teenagers and the adults back to the failure of the appropriate emotional state given the child in the first 18 months of life. So there we go. Antonio Damasio, one of our brilliant neuroscientists, pointed out that no matter how brilliant you might have a neocortical structure, the human brain up on top, what we think of as our intellectual creative brain, that it is critically dependent on the emotional cognitive system. That the high human brain is limited by the limitations of the emotional cognitive brain. Our cognition itself is limited by the emotional system. So if you want to develop higher levels of intelligence in a child, you must first of all have a thoroughly developed emotional cognitive system in that child, or you have no foundation to move on into the higher levels of human intelligence. And it's on this very basis that our whole educational system has been falling apart. Our whole social system is falling apart. Our family systems are falling apart because they're you might say, higher evolutionary intelligence is involved, and we're failing to put in that fundamental foundation of the emotional security, the safe space, the bonding of that infant with its mother. From conception on, that bond must be made.
millions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
Have you ever had a dream that you were so sure was real? What if you were to wake up in a dream?
Instinctively develops a natural equilibrium with the surrounding environment that you humans do not. You move to an area and you multiply. Multiply until every natural resource is consumed. The only way you can survive is to spread to another area. There is another organism on this planet that follows the same pattern.